Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Between Two Rivers, I'm spending time with the author Moody al-Rashid, Ancient Mesopotamia and the Birth of History. This is a teacher of languages and culture at Oxford University who's going to introduce us to storytelling 3,000, 4,000 years ago, just like today. But the story they all liked, just as we today have our favorites, Paul Bunyan, for example. The story they are liked is a king named Gilgamesh. He was 9 feet tall, goes the yarn, and he was cruel. And then he met a companion, and that companion guided him to understand that generosity and justice were the role of a king once upon a time. However, how do we know this? What were the languages that were commonplace in Uruk and Ur and Kish and Babylon, and how are those languages remembered and conquered? I'm greatly privileged to be speaking to someone who can not only read Sumerian, but she can speak Sumerian. Moody, Sumerian is the older, Akkadian is the newer. What do we need to know about those languages and how they were used?
Well, the first thing to know about them is how do we know about them, which is that they are recorded in a writing system called cuneiform. So they share a writing system, even if the languages are unrelated, just like we write French and English and German with some variations in this, using the same alphabet, although cuneiform is not an alphabet, strictly speaking. So it's a writing system developed around 3350 BCE, or at least its precursor was. And that's, a writing system that therefore gets used for over 3,000 years. That's half of human written history is in this writing system. And as you said, Sumerian is the more ancient of the main languages that it was used to write, and Akkadian, the newer one. And although the two are not related, the speakers of Akkadian from around 2000 BCE, once Sumerian died out, took great pains to keep that dead language alive. They translated the literature, they kept alive proverbs in the Sumerian language, and they used it for, particularly special documents. And even some medical literature employs Sumerian spells and incantations to heal people. And they wrote everything down. I mean, they have dictionaries, poetry, literature, including the Epic of Gilgamesh, as you said, receipts that tell us what people ate, how much onions cost, how much beer costs, the earliest written sciences, medical texts that tell us about everything from mental health to urinary tract diseases, astronomical texts that tell us about the earliest development of the zodiac, letters between wives and husbands complaining that they have too much to do and please come home and help me. It's just the most stunning, breathtaking corpus of information about people in their own words, telling us what they thought was important, what they experienced, and as with literature today, telling us what sorts of themes they really grappled with, and what they thought was worth thinking about.
Gilgamesh, magical. Yeah. Who was he? What do we know? Did he exist?
That's a million-dollar question. He's a legendary king, but we do think that there must have been a real Gilgamesh of some kind at some point, even if we haven't found contemporaneous records of him. And he survives primarily through stories, and most famously, a tale written in the Babylonian dialect of the Akkadian language called the Epic of Gilgamesh. And this story tells, you can ask 10 people who have read the Epic of Gilgamesh, and you'll get 10 different accounts of what the main themes of the story are. But essentially, you start off with this tyrant, Gilgamesh, who tortures his people. He forces them to fight with each other for sport. He forces them to build this humongous wall, which is does survive archaeologically, this 9 kilometer long wall, and worse. And it's about his transformation from this tyrant into a good king. And along the way, he meets his match in the form of a companion and possibly lover called Enkidu, a wild man who's described as being born in silence. In other words, he's not born out of childbirth. He just pops up in the wilderness one day and makes his way to Uruk to meet Gilgamesh through a series of circumstances. And they become great friends. They have this beautiful love story and they go on all these adventures. And then Enkidu dies. And that's a real wake-up call for Gilgamesh. He starts to panic about mortality and he goes on this quest for immortality. And instead of finding the key to immortality, he finds this deep wisdom about life from the oldest man in the world who survived the great flood that, you know, you have replicated in the Bible, for example. And this wisdom is essentially that life can be over in a second, and it's not about your personal survival, it's about the survival of the community. And he takes this wisdom back and becomes a really good king. So it's this beautiful, moving story about everything from love, loss, and to wisdom, to what it means to be a king and what it means to live, really.
And it's dated in a period that we believe Gilgamesh was also a king. I think that one way I can translate this is, was he there, King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table?
That's a lovely analogy, actually. I think something like that would make sense. He may have ruled if he was a real figure, in the probably the early third millennium BCE. So let's say 2800-ish BCE. And there were surely oral stories about him that then get committed to writing much later, around 2100 BCE, first in Sumerian, and then they kind of get mashed together into this later Babylonian or Akkadian epic that's very, very long. That's 12 tablets long, or 12 chapters, let's say. And it's really beautiful, beautifully written, but the Sumerian ones are also beautifully written. This is really high poetry that we're talking about this king.
Would any Galdi Nana known the stories of Gilgamesh that you just mentioned?
I mean, I can't say for sure, but I would say yes, she most likely knew, especially as a daughter of a king, because almost every king wanted to show that they were somehow something like Gilgamesh in some way, some more directly by claiming to have a shared genealogy with him or being connected with his mother, who is a goddess. But she certainly would have known who Gilgamesh was, even if there's no written piece of evidence that says I, Enigaldi Nana, knew who Gilgamesh was.
So 2,000 years later, it's commonplace, the Gilgamesh story, a detail about the Gilgamesh story. The word king itself, you give attention to that wasn't King wasn't right away. There were lords. I believe the letters E-N, is that Lord N?
N, exactly.
And so where did the kingship idea come from?
That's another great question that we're still struggling to answer. But, you know, there is an kind of Babylonian version of where kingship comes from. And the historical records just state that kingship descends from heaven in the city of Kish, which is very close to Babylon. So that's one way to account for it, is just something that spontaneously arises. But it's more likely that there was a kind of gradual development from this N, this Lord figure, who appears in really early sources. And some of the earliest examples of writing reference of the N of the city of Uruk, for example, or maybe it's Jemdet Nasser, I can't remember exactly. And then the ark, again, going back to this idea of buildings telling a story, archaeology, sort of architecture, tracks this political development, because again, in the city of Kish, we start to see buildings that are not temples, but that are quite lavish and beautifully decorated and huge. And the idea is possibly that these are the earliest palaces, because temples don't get abandoned. They just get built, rebuilt, rebuilt, renovated, and rebuilt over and over again on the same site because they have that much importance. But a palace can be abandoned, and these buildings do get abandoned and serve as cemeteries in later periods, and they look like they were probably abandoned quite quickly. So it's possible that in the sort of early third millennium BCE, we start to see the figure of a king arise who deserves his own palace, and this idea of a single leader of a city that then gets passed down through bloodline as opposed to some other method of choosing the city's leader. But it's such an interesting question. There are other ways that scholars have tried to account for it, suggesting that, for example, kings might be the husbands of goddesses who were at the kind of stronghold of the pantheon in the really early periods and then later displaced by gods. But that's yet to be completely proven.
Now we come to a mystery. Sargon of Akkad. I've already tasked Moody to find Akkad. Who is Sargon? Why do we start with him?
So Sargon is a leader who rises in around 2330 BCE. He brings the Akkadian language to, I mean, he and his people bring the Akkadian language to the region. And what's interesting about Sargon is that we have this first example of really vast expansion of an empire. Before him, it was city states and they all kind of ruled at the same time independently. And maybe they fought with each other a bit, but no one figure ruled over multiple cities. Sargon, when he rises to power, he just sort of sweeps through the region and his dynasty goes, you know, as far north as Syria, covering most of Iraq as well. So he's the first real empire builder, for better or worse. And lots of myths arise around him. So many myths about how to be a good king, and so many later kings try to tie themselves to this first Sargon, including taking the name Sargon. Some of the Assyrian kings took the name Sargon when they rose to the throne. So he was a really important and powerful figure throughout the history of the region.
All right, and to be done is to find his city, Akkad. Which is somewhere in this region. We know where Kish is. We know where Uruk is. We know where Ur is. We know Babylon. There are other cities we've located, but not Akkad, not yet. And I've asked Moody to find it, and she said she would try. Right, Moody?
Absolutely.
We need a budget. We need ground penetrating radar, and we will start the search. I believe Samarra is where the scholars now point us to start there. However, we're going to turn to something that is even more magical than Sargon. That's going to school in Mesopotamia 4,000 years ago. Moody Al-Rashid is the author of a new book, Between Two Rivers. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.